session number 19655, Reel 1.
'99 with Mrs. Atherton Harrison. Could you tell me about your early life?
Yes, indeed. I was born in 1915, and I was a posthumous child because my father was killed at Gallipoli in the First World War. And I went to art school and studied theatre design, and was just beginning my career in the West End Theatre when the later war started, and all theatres closed, and so there was no work. And I'd rather hoped to get into camouflage or something where I could use my so-called skills of theatre design, but I didn't succeed in that. But vaguely through various friends, I heard that the Ministry of Information was setting up a new section to censor newspapers and magazines, because strangely in the Second World War it was voluntary submission, so that newspapers didn't have to get permission before they published, but they were called over the coals if they contravened the Defence of the Realm Act. So the newspapers and magazines all had to be read every day, and they were setting up a team to do this. And we were we had a week's time in which we were told about the job, and had lectures from various people, like the deputy director of the ministry, who was Mr. Radcliffe. And then we started on the job, and I did that for about a year, and it was very interesting, and we were a very good team of people, all ages and both sexes, and about 20 of us, I think, and we went in every day and read newspapers all day long. And there were long hours, and Saturdays as well, you didn't have, and sometimes Sundays. And of course, at night we were being bombed, and so one rushed back home. My mother was still in our flat in Kensington, and one rushed back to try and have something to eat before the bombing started. And then you went down into the basement of the house where our flat was. And often you didn't have much sleep. We all had near misses, I think, and some more than that. In fact, a very dear friend, Susan Otto, who was an actress and who was one part of the team of scrutineers, as we were called, and she was killed in a raid on Ebury Street, where she lived. And this sort of thing, of course, was going on all the time. But you had a sort of feeling that if there had been a particularly bad night of bombing, then you must be on time, because you didn't want people to think that you had failed to come in because you were worn out with the night's events. And so it was a sort of unwritten law that when the bombing was very bad, you weren't going to be late if you could possibly avoid it. And of course, you didn't know how you were going to get to work, because the buses were all over the place, because the route they wanted to go had probably been bombed in the night. And so they had to work their way around it, and you found yourself in all sorts of very peculiar places trying to get to work. And then after about a year doing that,
could I ask you to describe in greater detail what the work of scrutineers involved? Did you, for example, always read the same newspaper?
No, I don't think we did. I think to give us a bit of variety, each morning your newspapers and magazines were in a shelf ready, marked for you, so that you knew that you'd get variety, which it would have been hell if you hadn't. And it was exhausting. You had a blue pencil, of course, and you marked anything that you thought was suspicious. I made a terrible bloomer. I think it was the only one I made. And that was to pass a photograph of two free French sailors who had escaped from France after the fall of France and had joined the Free French Navy in England. And, of course, we tried stop papers showing photographs of them because it might have caused trouble to their families in France. And I felt dreadful I had passed that photograph.
Had you overlooked it, or had you not been aware at that time of this danger?
I'd overlooked it because I knew perfectly well that that was a rule. But of course it had been published anyhow. It hadn't done any more damage, but what I had failed to do was to send that up to the Miss Wingate, who she was Aud Wingate's sister, and she was in charge of the 20 scrutineers in so much as you sent up to her. And then there was Flight Lieutenant Tyler, who I think was in charge of the unit. He wore a uniform all the time, and he once took me the top, I think it was the top 8 floors of Senate House where we worked, that although they had allowed it to be built before the war, they had not allowed the top 8 floors to be lived in or worked in. And so it was a shell, but there was stairs that went up onto the roof, because that's where the observers, the observer corps, were looking out for the enemy planes. And he took me up there once to see it, and of course it wasn't allowed, and I think he got into terrible trouble for taking me up there, but it was very impressive to see what the observer corps were doing, watching out for planes. It was all pretty amateurish, right? In a way, thinking of radar and so on now. It was just a couple of men with binoculars.
Can you remember any of the other scrutineers, who they were? Did they come from similar backgrounds to yourself?
Well, I suppose you could say they were all educated people. They had to be. They were interesting people. There was a woman who ran a flower shop in quite a well-known one in the West End. And she was one. Susan Otto, who was an actress. And then, the name has gone from me. Peter Quinnell. And then there was also Derek Tangi's mother-in-law, Jean Nichols' mother, Mrs. Nichols, who was a great character, and we had lots of laughs, which made the tedium go rather more quickly. And we worked hard, but after about a year doing that reading every day, I got conjunctivitis and couldn't carry on any longer, and so inquired what jobs were going in the ministry, and discovered that the Latin American section needed somebody to cope with photographs, and I applied for the job and got it. It was at first just a job of sending out war photographs, which came in from the agencies every day and were put up in a room in the ministry, where those of us who were dealing with photographs for all countries of the world used to go in 2 or 3 times a day and see what the new photographs were, and if we thought they would be useful to send to press attaches in our particular country. And of course I was dealing with the 21 Latin American republics.
You would make the selection yourself, would you?
I would make the selection myself. And one was sending out photographs that you thought would be useful for propaganda, for the press attaches to try and get into the Latin American papers. I understood that our job was really to bring the Latin American countries in, if possible, on the side of the Allies and not the Axis. And particularly, I think we were concerned with Argentina because there was so much money, British money, involved in Argentina. Uruguay was very pro-British, but Argentina was not. And so we gave special effort to say, in fact, Britain has got her back to the wall, but we still think of Latin America as our allies and partners, and hope that after the war, after we've won this war for you, we're not saying it quite like that, then we will be able to work together and trade and industry and so on.
You mentioned the 21 republics. Did you distinguish between different countries for different photos?
Yes, indeed. But basically the real news photographs that you wanted everybody to see, basically they would go to all the countries. But you would make a slight difference between, say, Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay and Ecuador and so on, because perhaps the press attaches had told you what was particularly interesting for them and that kind of thing. And then I tried to build up a library of photographs for the press attaches, so that when something happened in a different part of the world, they would have photographs that they could use. And I got into not exactly trouble, but it was interesting because I was getting a collection of photographs of different parts of the world that I thought might be interesting, and included Persia, Iran. And I got a very cryptic note from the head of, I can't remember who the note came from, but it's very high up in the ministry, not to send the photographs of Persia. And really soon after that, there was a move into Persia, and so I had, if I'd sent them, it might have been a slight worry. So it was interesting that things like that happened, and you felt in a way that you were part of the bigger organization that was worldwide.
How regular contact did you have with the press attachés in the different embassies around South America?
Of course, we wrote letters. There was no other way of communicating. And so I wrote letters, and they wrote to me saying, we would like photographs of so-and-so. We want more Air Force photographs. We want more Navy photographs and that kind of thing. So, yes, we were in contact. But, of course, because of the time distance and the difficulty of... You didn't speak to anybody on the telephone, anything like that. It was all a bit at a distance.
The Ministry of Information was divided into divisions, so there was a photographs division, a films division.
Yes.
How closely did you work together? Were there campaigns where, for instance, there was a film made about the BBC, which was intended to be shown to Catholics in Latin America? Did you mount campaigns together? Were you aware of a coordination of propaganda policy?
Not, I think, at my level. I was probably the junior of the Latin American section. And the head of the Latin American section for most of the time that I was there was Kenneth Grubb. He was a delightful man, very nice to work with.
Was he an academic?
Yes, very much so, I would say. I don't know what his background was, but he was very well known in Latin America. And then his second in command was Oliver Bonham Carter, who eventually took over when Kenneth Grubb went, I think he became head of the American section, or anyhow, he was promoted, and Oliver Bonham Carter took over. I worked originally in the section which was on the third, fourth floor of the ministry, and I shared...
Which was the photograph section?
No, it was the Latin American section at first, but I did eventually become attached to the photograph section. But I started off in the Latin American section. I shared a room with Miss Willans, an elderly spinster who spoke Spanish, I think, and Portuguese. And she was doing my job only with regard to articles, paper articles. And so she was reading all day long, and I was sorting photographs out and sending parcels and that kind of thing. And I was in the midst of my romance with my dear husband, and so was forever telephoning him, or he was telephoning me, and I think I drove her mad, poor woman. Looking back on it, must have been very irritating. Anyhow, after a while I realised that I couldn't go on like that, so I scouted round the ministry to see if I could find somewhere else to work. And down in the basement there was a large room which the windows were sandbagged. There, it was basement, but there were windows that were half up and half down, if you know what I mean. But they were sandbagged, so they were useless as light. But the walls had some form of boarding on them, which would take drawing pins. So I thought, this is wonderful, I could pin up my photographs. And as I was beginning to develop, quite unofficially, a different sphere to my work. I was beginning to do exhibitions of photographs to send out to, for instance, I got a collection of all the prize bulls that had been sent out to Argentina, because Argentina's beef was all British bulls. And so I did an exhibition of all the bulls, which went down rather well in Argentina. And then I did the exhibition of dolls dressed in Latin American national costume, which I did with Norman Hartnell. And various exhibitions of that kind. I did a Roman Catholic schools exhibition, and the Roman Catholic bishop, I forget his name, but he was attached to the RAF, and he came and sort of said how nice it was before it went out to Latin America. And I also came in contact quite a bit with Sir Kenneth Clark, Lord Clark, because he was the... I forget exactly what his position was. He wasn't the minister, but he was sort of second or third in command. And I started off getting in touch with him because I think the Chilean press attaché from Chile had written and asked for a photograph of a portrait of Admiral Cochrane, who was involved in the history of Chile. And I scouted round the Charing Cross Road until I found a rather nice print of a portrait of the Admiral. But I wasn't sure whether it was suitable from a historical point of view and an artistic point of view. And so I thought, well, with Sir Kenneth Clark sitting upstairs, who better could I ask? So I bounced upstairs and got into his office, which was not easy. And I think he was rather intrigued. And so he helped me to do that. And then... when it came to...
Was he able to answer immediately?
Oh, yes, yes, he was very knowledgeable man. And then I got involved with him over Paul Nash, who he offloaded onto me. So that was sort of an interesting episode. And the exhibition of the Latin American dolls was great fun, I must say. That was one of the highlights of my ministry life. Where do we go from here?
You mentioned that you sent a special exhibition on about Roman Catholic schools to Latin America.
Yes.
Could I ask whether you ever had any concern during the war of the persecution of the Jewish faith? Because there is a large Jewish community in Latin America.
Certainly. But you must remember that I was a very junior member of the section. Mr. Walter Fitzgerald, there was Mr. Bock. There were a whole group of quite eminent men who had connections with Latin America and who were obviously dealing with the policies and so on, which passed me by completely. But I remember Oliver Bonham Carter, when he was the head of the section, saying to me, because I used to leave on the dot of six to join my husband wherever he was, and I remember him saying, "You're the worst clock watcher on my team," but he said, "You have the best ideas." So I decided that I was able to leave dead on 6 o'clock.
The pictures which came in from the agencies, were there copyright implications for your distribution of those to Latin America?
Well, they would all have been government sponsored, wouldn't they? I mean, yes, they were Fox photographs and Keystone and agencies like that, but we certainly were not involved in any copyright. So I imagine it was all under the auspices of the government.
And did you send parcels of prints, or would you send a duped negative?
Parcels of prints, actually.
And never negative, Daryl?
No. And I used to simply put a rubber band round a parcel and a slip of paper saying where it had to go, and then it went downstairs to the packing department. And, of course, most of it went by sea because there wasn't any regular air post or anything like that. Diplomatic bag, I suppose, would go by air sometimes. But, for instance, the exhibition of war artists' paintings that I organized, that went by sea and was, in fact, torpedoed. And then we sent 4 paintings by air to make up for the fact that they didn't get the exhibition they were expecting, which was sad.
So the subject matter of these prints was hardly hot news. It was more background.
It was background. But, of course, you did send the hot news, but, of course, by the time it got to them, it was pretty cold. But it would build up a library for them.
You were never asked to send the material by airmail in order to overcome the advantage that...
No, I don't think so. I don't seem to remember. That might have been something specific, but I can't remember. The only time I remember sending something by air were those 4 pictures that Lord Clark allowed me to send after the others had been torpedoed.
Were you at all aware of picture film propaganda being carried out by the United States in Latin America?
No, but I do remember that there was a certain amount of to-ing and fro-ing between, what was it called in America?
The Rockefeller Foundation.
The Rockefeller Foundation. And some of our more senior members went there. And obviously there were discussions held, but they didn't filter down to me.
And also, were you aware at all of the impact of German propaganda in Latin America?
I wasn't, no.
Finally, could I ask you to describe the actual your physical existence within the MOI building, if I can put it that way, where you were in relation to the films division? Did you work in relatively self-contained parts of the building? Were there opportunities to meet with other people in a canteen? Or you've described, obviously, your work as extremely intensive until 6 o'clock came.
Yes, then I went. Yes, we were very confined. I don't suppose there were more than about 4 or 5 rooms that were the Latin American section. The American section, of course, was very much bigger.
Was that near yours?
I can't remember, because we were so confined into our little area until I got out and went down to the basement. And then I did manage to
cross borders
a little bit, but not very much. You could go every morning, if you wanted, to the briefing that was held, the news briefing. And I would pop in on that sometimes, but I didn't really have the time. I would like to have listened more to what was going on. It was a news briefing every morning.
This was a news briefing given...
For the whole of the ministry. I don't know. I certainly was allowed to go if I wanted to.
Was it also for the journalists?
It was for the journalists, yes, mainly, yes. And there was the press section, which was on the ground floor, and one did walk through that quite a lot, and that's where the journalists were and where all the news came. And so when there were battles going on and exciting things happening, we got the news very early, because the first time it appeared would be there in the news department. I don't think I have nothing to do with the film section, which was really rather strange, considering my husband was very much involved in making instructional films. But I don't think that there was any practical filmmaking going on in the Senate House. I think it was just the offices of the film unit with Jack Beddington. I don't think that one got involved. There was a canteen, which one used sometimes, but very often we took sandwiches or went home or tried to do shopping for food, because it was the only, your lunch hour really was taken up with trying to do your own life living, shopping and coping with the daily chores and things. So because the lunch time was the only time you had.
Was any part of Senate House still used by the University of London?
I don't think so. No, I'm sure there wasn't.
Was there a library in the building?
There was a photographic library, of course. No, I don't think there was a library. I certainly never used one.
Because nowadays, that is where the main University of London library is located.
Yes, no, it wasn't then. I don't think at all. One did get a little communication with people. When I, after a while, I was moved from the Latin American department. I still did Latin American propaganda, but because I was photographed, all the photograph people were moved in under the section of the, and that the head of that was Charles Gibb Smith, who later became the second in command at the V&A, and he had been at the V&A before the war. And he was head of the library there. And I knew him quite well because of my work in costume. It was a very big unit, the photograph unit. And it was quite a scandal, the lady who got involved with spy.
Talking of spies, there was Nun May, who worked in the Ministry of Information at that time. Did you encounter
him? Never came across him, no.
Which was the spy that...
I believe there was one woman who was attached to the Latin American section for a little bit, And she was, I heard afterwards, MI5. And I wondered why she took my husband and I out for drinks. Because I didn't think that, she would really have wanted to. And we were both rather surprised when she took us to somewhere like Claridge's for drinks. And I heard after the war that she was MI5. And she was checking on my husband, obviously.
Can you recall the name of the Minister of Information at the time that you were there? Would that have been Duff Cooper or Brendan Bracken?
Brendan Bracken, first of all.
Duff Cooper preceded Brendan Bracken.
Yes, but Brendan Bracken, I think, had taken over by the time I was there. I don't remember Duff Cooper being there, but I could be wrong about that. And who came after Brendan Bracken?
He remained until the end of the war.
Oh, that's right, he did, yes. Yes, I never came into contact with him at all. Towards the end of my time there, you had to do occasional all-night sessions, really manning the telephone, and it was really...